the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Vanti Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have with us Tanya DePass, founder and director of I Need Diverse Games, Twitch streamer, podcaster, game critic, and editor of the upcoming anthology, Tales from the Margin. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Hey, Jen, how are you? Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm good. I'm excited you're here. So let's dive right in. Tell us about yourself and what you do.
Well, I'm a native Chicagoan, for anyone who wants random trivia about me. I'm a longtime gamer, and I literally was kind of mad about video games one day on the internet. And from that moment of anger and hashtagging, I've now become the director of my own nonprofit and work for myself. I spend way too much time thinking and talking about Dragon Age, probably. I've been getting slowly back into tabletop gaming and, you know, stream games, do silly things like make Sims of my friends, and not silly in a bad way, silly as in a, I have way too much fun with this. You know, I get a chance to go to conventions, do a lot of panels, do a lot of public speaking, and all of that is wrapped around my care about diversity in games and how it can be better, how we can have a useful and fruitful conversation about diversity in games and where we fail to do so. You know, even the discourse about, there's a black protagonist. Why do I have to be a black protagonist? And everything else that comes with it. So I talk a lot. Luckily, people like what I have to say, and they occasionally pay me to do that, to write about it. And I'm now an accidental advocate for diversity in games, and that's what I do for a living.
That's awesome. And that's how I found you, because it seemed to be a topic that not enough people were talking about, and it was clearly an issue. And I know for you, a large part of the diversity issue, of course, is people of color in games. So I'm curious if you can, how is the game industry doing overall? I mean, it's really interesting to me recently watching a company like Blizzard that has some really problematic representation in games like World of Warcraft, for instance, but now is out there doing Overwatch. And I'm hoping that's a trend, but I'm curious what you think about it.
Well, in general, I think it is very, very slow movement toward getting better. People are paying attention to these things. You know, people going, hey, there's not any queer representation, or I should say explicit queer representation. Or, you know, there's brown people, but they're that ambiguous brown that no one can quite tell where they're supposed to be from, what ethnicity they would be. So it's getting better, but at a very slow pace, and some people have to be drag kicking and screaming, just like anything else that happens in terms of the diversity conversation. It would be great if we could have that nuanced conversation about diversity in games, and the fact that people of color, queer folks, non-binary, trans, and everyone who is not cis, straight, white, able-bodied dude, our money spends just like everyone else's, and it'd be great to see ourselves in this content. And then specifically about Overwatch, I'm a new player to it, because for a long time the game made me very, very motion sick, and I couldn't really get into it. And I still can't watch other people play it. But it's one of those things where it's like, you did really good on this one section, and then you totally missed the mark on the other. Like, some of the skins are very problematic.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, I see this, and I'm like, you know, you've got a skin that's a deity that people actually worship. Maybe you shouldn't do that. I don't know. And the upcoming character, Doomfist, I feel a certain way about. And I know a lot of people are excited because, yay, we finally get a black dude. But again, he's a villain. His name is Doomfist. He's literally a big black dude. And there's been all kind of discourse and conversation already, and he's not even available yet. And it's one of those things where I'm like, did anyone at the studio think about this before they conceived this character?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch because, like, I specifically avoid any of the culturally coded skins for the characters because I'm uncomfortable doing so, particularly as a white woman. And it seems that Blizzard, in some cases, has been sort of retconning those skins to make them appropriate to the character, as is the case of Farrah, for instance, with the Thunderhawk skin from the First Nations cultures. And now people are saying, oh, it's her dad. Doomfist has been an interesting conversation as well, because you do have Lucio, who is a good guy, Afro-Brazilian, which is awesome. But then they're falling into the potential problematic tropes of the big, scary black man as the villain. Hopefully they actually do have a nuanced approach to it, but I still don't have faith in the gaming industry for that.
So I try to participate in fandoms. However, the Overwatch fandom is one that kind of like burned me quick and early before I was even playing the game. And, you know, for whatever opinion people hold about Tumblr and the space that it is, it was a little frightening seeing how fast people embraced Doomfist and the ways in which they did it, because there was a lot of, oh, we finally get a black dude. And like, you know, hey, if that's the representation you've been looking for and you get it, awesome. But we have this 2-minute video where he's punching his way out of a cell versus the very nuanced backstory that a lot of people are not going to read, they're not going to care about, because at the core of it, Overwatch is a shooter. But we've already got people fetishizing this dude, and he's not even out yet for the general population who plays Overwatch. And I'm like, I'm just going to be in my corner with my main, and I'm just going to pretend I did not see any of this.
Yeah, I was really excited about Orisa, at least, but now I just want Effie as a main character, so, you know, what do I know, though? But one of the ways that I think diversity clearly is important is not just in front of the camera, so to speak, but behind the scenes in terms of the creators. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's great to have more diversity on screen, what we're seeing, like more characters, more well-rounded characters, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to think about who's making those games. For anyone who follows the International Game Developer Association, every year they do a diversity survey. And I don't know if 2016 numbers are out yet, but the last one that I use and I reference a lot are disheartening, because it's still 75% white dudes who are making these games. Some ethnicities don't even come in up to 1% of representation of who is making games. And it's important because if you don't have people from different backgrounds in the studio, especially people at a decision-making level, things that are offensive, things that are terrible, are not going to be caught before they make it into production, or, you know, if something's shown at E3 or whatever, and then you're going to have fan reactions that are not good. So you need people not just getting excited about what we see on screen when we finally get the game as consumers, but who's there storyboarding, who's there conceiving these characters, who's making decisions about the final look of a character and their backstory and their origin, how they interact with the game world. So you need people across the board, especially at higher levels. Because a lot of times you'll see concept art way after the fact where it's like, why did you change this character? One thing that comes to mind is for Mass Effect Andromeda, Cora Harper was initially, I think, Indian or black. And yet the final game, we got her with her I want to speak to your manager haircut. So, you know, and same with Dragon Age, a lot of the characters were a lot darker in that concept art. And look at what we got in terms of the final product. So things like that are why it's important to have people at all levels.
And one of the things that I've noticed too, not just in terms of the developers, but the gaming community itself and the amount of more outspoken women and men of color that are coming out and talking about these subjects seems to be kind of important, particularly in terms of the Twitch communities, which you are clearly a part of. You've got a fantastic Twitch stream talking about all of these topics. But tell me a little bit about the Twitch streaming community in terms of support for people of color.
I probably should have asked how much I can cuss before I take on this question.
So much cussing.
You know, I enjoy streaming on Twitch. It's something I actually started doing because of Dragon Age Inquisition's release, and the support for people of color, especially black women, just isn't there. I don't know who listens that saw Twitch Unity Day. It was announced 2 weeks before it was supposed to happen. There were no black women in the promo material. Everyone that was held up was mostly a white queer person. They had a couple black dudes and like one, they had a couple women of color, but I don't know if they were black women. And there's like one black woman that I know that's a partner streamer. So there's not a lot of diversity in who's highlighted, who really gets the center stage. You still can't stream without people being assholes. I was streaming, I think, The Sims the other day, and I still got people coming into the chat, doing the emote harassment, which is, I forget the guy's name, because he was famous before I got on Twitch, but he's like a League of Legends or something player, and he's got a emote, and people will like use that, and banana, and monkey, and watermelon, and use that when they see someone as a black person streaming. Or, you know, just the usual slurs. And there's not a lot you can do. It's on the streamer to create that community, create those walls, to make their own space safe. But, you know, if Twitch is now going to do things like let affiliates have subscriptions, let us get revenue, things like that, offer the affiliate program, which is a gap between streaming and being a partner, it also needs to do better by streamers that are not the cis straight bearded white dude who like gets on there and screams and yells and has 20,000 followers because of that. Like when it's hard because you never know what's going to bring racist trolls out. I stream a little bit of everything, but the worst I got was streaming Mafia 3. You know, it's a black protagonist. It's a very violent game, and anyone who watches it should be aware of that. And, you know, you get to be a black dude, a very big, angry black dude who has a revenge fantasy. He is acting out. And yet I still got all the racist assholes coming out of the woodwork because I played a game with a black protagonist. And this is, you know, circles back to that lack of a nuanced discussion, because no one is forcing anyone to watch someone else on Twitch. If you don't want to watch black streamers, don't watch black streamers. You don't have to also then be an asshole and be racist and come in with slurs and everything else. So I think right now that there's Automod, there's tools, they're very slowly trying to do better, but it's at too slow of a pace. I think there really needs to be better tools, actually banning people, banning partners that don't uphold the TOS, you know, people that drunk stream and do things like that, that are not, you know, on paper, it's not what Twitch is supposed to be about. But like Twitter, people harass and abuse and nothing happens.
There's clearly a lot of work to be done on a lot of fronts. So everybody go follow I Need Diverse Games just for these conversations, exactly this. But we're also getting from you, and I'm super excited about this, you are going to be editing an anthology called Tales from the Margins. So can you tell us about that and what you're looking for, what the goal is?
So for those that follow a lot of books about game dev and other things, last year Jennifer Hepler did a book called Women in Game Development, Breaking the Glass Level Cap. And it's by CRC Press, and I did a review of it, and she and I started talking. I'm also a big Dragon Age nerd, so I had my fangirl moment. But then she messaged me and was like, you know, they asked me about a follow-up to this book. I think the next logical step is talking about marginalized identities in the industry, but that's not my lane. Would you be interested? And she helped me with the pitch. I got it out to CRC Press. They accepted. Call for submissions is going on right now to August 15th, so it's a little over a month left. So what I am looking for, and I'm going to be specific because I had to write an FAQ, is people who are in the industry or adjacent of a marginalized identity and a personal essay on how your identity or axis of identities, you know, like if you're a person of color and queer, if you are disabled and trans, or all of the above, how your identity or crossroads of identity has affected your place in the industry. You know, be that, you know, maybe an experience you've had in your current studio, why you got in the industry, because for some people, that's what motivates them to get in the industry. It's like, okay, no one's making the content I want to see. I'm going to go do it. And then there's room for a few essays for people adjacent to the industry, but also looking at that kind of crossroads of identity. So people who do podcasting, who do game journalism. But it all should be a personal essay about your place in the industry or very adjacent to the industry, how your identity has informed your work, or, you know, something along those lines. This isn't meant to be a how to get into game dev book. This isn't meant to be an academic book. This is a personal essay anthology. So people who are thinking about it or who have been in the industry, new in the industry, because I want stories from all levels, not just I've been in the industry for 20 years and I've survived everything going on. I would love to hear from people in the industry just for a couple years or people about to go in the industry who are about to graduate or, you know, are months away from starting that first gig. And that's what I would like. So people that are in the industry, an essay up to 2,500 words. For people that are adjacent, an essay up to 1,500 words. Both are paid. The adjacent essays will get paid from iNeedverse Games. Everything else is getting taken care of by CRC Press. So questions about it, send them to marginsantho@gmail.com. And then the link will be in the show notes for the submission guidelines and FAQ. But very quickly, it is cyphertier.com/marginsantho. That has all the info, as well as a link to shoot me an email. I'm actually not traveling until after the deadline. So you can actually probably get a quick answer from me. So it's a very short Google form I've got there right now. And then submit your essay. And after the deadline closes, I'll be reading a lot of words.
Awesome. I'm very excited about it. I think it's going to be a really, really interesting look at the industry overall. So other than that, let us know where people can find you and your work.
Easiest way to probably find me is on Twitter. So that's CYPHEROFTYR. And I'm Cypher of Tear pretty much everywhere on the internet. So that's Twitch, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, just about anywhere that has a presence. That's my name there. And for the work of iNeedverse Games, if you want to follow us on Twitter at iNeedDivGMS, that's our Twitter handle. Everything else is pretty much iNeedDiverseGames.org, as we are a 501c3 nonprofit. So anyone listening who is feeling a bit generous and has a bit of a cash to spare, we are a 501c3, and we've got a Patreon, which is our only funding, and that's patreon.com/iNeedDivGames.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tanya. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
You are so welcome. This was fun, and I'm glad we had a chance to chat finally.
Yeah, me too. And everybody else, go check out Tanya's stuff and iNeedverse Games. It's excellent work and really worth supporting. Thank you so much.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fandy Show. I'm Sean, and today on Signo Boost, we have Hope Nicholson, writer and editor of Many Glorious Things, two of which we're going to talk about today on this episode. So welcome to the show, Hope.
Hi, good to be here.
So to get us started, I actually want to start talking about The Spectacular Sisterhood of Superwomen, which is out from Quirk Books, came out in May. So it's just brand new, it's just on the shelves. And I was hoping you could tell folks a little bit about this book and what inspired you to write it.
Yeah, so it's basically a general history of comics, except instead of from a male point of view, which most comic book histories just inherently are, it's from a female point of view. So focusing a lot on female creators and characters specifically, and also the role of what fangirls have had in the industry since the beginning of the 1930s. I basically do about 10 different profiles for different characters for each decade, and it's definitely a sampler. It's not like the best characters by far, and it's not like the most influential or the best-selling or anything like that, but just characters that to me represent a different facet of the industry decade to decade to give people who've never read comics before an idea of what the history is, and for people who've read comics, focusing on really obscure characters for the most part.
Yeah, so that's something that I noticed is, you know, some of these characters I'd heard of because, you know, if you look into comic history, you know, stuff pops up, so you've got some characters who become really famous in advertising, for example, and then other characters, which you even admit in the book, have just been lost, like practically lost to history. And I was curious, in the process of researching and putting together this book, how did you find all these characters? Because some of them aren't reprinted. They're like, you have to go to like crazy, obscure, hard to find back issues of stuff to find them.
Yeah, absolutely. Sally the Sleuth was actually really hard because I ended up going to a collector who had a large collection of them that he would just reprint full issues of. And I asked him if he could send me just Sally the Sleuth scans, and he luckily was able to send me about 30 of them. So that was a really big help. So being able to ask for help and get comics sent to me and get scans sent to me was a really big thing. Also, the public domain characters are mostly scanned online, so that was also very helpful. But a lot of times, yeah, finding unusual characters, I went through some databases that were already pre-built, like the public domain characters database, looking for female characters. But a lot of times I just pulled up data from spreadsheets of comics history and just looked for names that looked vaguely feminine. Things like Ms. Tree, which I'd never heard of before. And it was actually quite a big independent comic book in the 1980s. And so I just found that from a friend suggesting it to me and then seeing it in a few lists. So yeah, it was kind of a weird, varied course. Sometimes I asked for help, but a lot of times I just went through a lot of data.
Just sitting online for hours and hours.
Pretty much. Like, I went to comics.org is great because, like, it's full of really passionate people who database their comics collections. So I just exported all of that and went through, like, just years and years of names looking for interesting characters.
That's awesome. So the other thing, you know, in putting together this book, I noticed there's a tone to this book that's actually rather positive, which I found really refreshing because usually subjects like this, you know, kind of bringing up the women creators and so on throughout history, it's kind of dark because comics has been a very male-centric industry and still, I think, to a large respect, is. And so I'm curious, and did your research for this book give you a more positive view of comics, or was that just kind of a tonal thing you wanted to go with to be just more upbeat?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a consideration that the publisher imparted on me, is that they wanted it to be more about characters who were kind of inspiring or interesting. But unfortunately, I couldn't tell a history of comics with just inspiring characters because it would be kind of inaccurate. So I did make sure to show some faulty characters, too, like characters that represented bad parts of the industry or like more morally complex parts, we'll say, like Witchblade. So, yeah, so that was definitely a publisher mandate to keep it a bit more positive in tone. I had cut a bunch of characters from the book during my editing process because I was very negative to them. The overall history of comics is really interesting because there have been women working in the comics industry and fans in the comic book industry who are women since the beginning of comics. But it's actually also depressing when you find that out because then you think, well, why is this the first time I'm hearing of this? Why did I get the idea that it was completely male dominated?
Yeah, that's another this weirdness within basically any industry from like pre-1980 of like women being involved in stuff and nobody knows that they were involved in that stuff. And we're like now just discovering they were there, like Hidden Figures. And
yeah, it's hard because it's because the histories are written by certain sectors of people, like especially like white men write the most histories. And because of that, it's always going to be slanted from a white male point of view. So it's kind of unfortunate. So I think we definitely need to have more historians and be reading more histories that are by people who aren't white men, who are women of color, who are, you know, intersex and queer and transgender people, because it's really important to be able to have different perspectives. And even if you're doing overall history, your own perspective does guide the history and what you notice and what you don't notice.
That's true. So I want to change gears just a little bit because I want to talk about some of my favorite characters and get your perspective on who were your favorite characters. So in like the first section, you talk about Torchy Brown. She sounds like such a fascinating character. And you do have quite a lot on her before you switch over to talking about Little Lulu, who is sort of for that particular decade in the very first section, you put Little Lulu as like the defining character. But Torchy Brown like had all these really weird like you get the little figures and you put the little paper stuff around them where you could dress her up?
Paper dolls, yeah.
Where did you find that? Was that just like hiding in advertising or was it something that you found in the comics themselves?
No, actually, Torchy Brown's pretty hard to track because it was primarily a newspaper supplement comic. So it was a comic that was only distributed in newspapers. So for that reason, it's a bit harder to find. But there were histories on the subject and of the creator. And that's where I got the scans from.
Okay, fascinating. So if you had to pick a character, like in all of this book, like your favorite character, who would be your favorite character?
You know what? That's actually really hard because they're all, you know, fairly important, interesting characters in their own right. I really like Bold Riley, which was from the 2010 section because she's a character that I think could have so much more exposure. And she unfortunately doesn't. And that's a big thing because that's something we can change now. And that's the story of like a lesbian Indian adventurous princess, and it's really fun, and it's also like a little bit sexy but not overly sexual, and it's just a really great story that I hope more people pay attention to.
I like Bandette from that section.
Yeah, Bandette's really fun.
Yeah, the 2010s in particular seemed like a lot of very more fun kind of, like, almost like built for a very particular kind of quirky comic reading audience. But I don't know if that's what you came out with, the 2010 section, but that's what it seemed like to me.
I think it's also what I'm gravitating towards. So the 2010s is really the decade where I've been the most present and focused on comics. And because of that, I've been able to kind of pick and choose from things that I've seen online, things that friends have written, things that get people in my own social sphere really excited about. And a lot of that is really positive, exciting, happy kind of comics, because we haven't had a lot of that. And it's nice just to have really simple stories that kind of take you away from the world. Kind of like the first time, I think, since the 1950s that we really had comics as this kind of escapism, but also with like a really strong moral center.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, okay, so we got to switch gears, because the other work that I wanted to talk about was your new collection called Love Beyond Body, Space, and Time, which is a collection of science fiction fantasy stories focusing on LGBT and two-spirit characters from an indigenous perspective. So I'm curious what, first, kind of to get started, is what led you to putting together this project?
For me, it came of two things. One is that I was working on the Moonshot comics anthology, and I really wanted to include a two-spirit comic in it, and I wasn't able to find anyone who wanted to do one for the project. And so for me, it was really important, because a lot of two-spirit content gets left out of both, you know, queer anthologies, but also indigenous anthologies. So I knew there was a lot of content out there. And for me, sci-fi is a really important thing because sci-fi helps us see a future. And for a lot of stories featuring indigenous characters and content, it's set in the past, or it's set in a really unpleasant version of the present, which is unfortunately a present that does exist. So for this collection, I wanted to tell stories about love and have it all by indigenous authors featuring indigenous characters, and have it set, you know, in the future or in alternate worlds, and have, for the most part, really positive, exciting, uplifting stories, because that's something we don't see enough of.
Yeah, I agree. So the term two spirits, because we've used it, a lot of people may not be familiar with this particular term. Could you explain it for everybody, what that term means?
I think it would probably be best to ask a indigenous person what it means, because it is different. And it depends too. It's a fairly new term. I think it's only come about in this century. And that's because each nation tends to have their own specific terminology and words and concepts of gender and sexuality. So there really isn't one overarching, you know, term for queerness or gayness in indigenous cultures, because each culture is very distinct and different. Some might not have any terms for it, and some might have as many as like six different gender pronouns, you know? So two-spirit was a term that was invented in this century, I believe, that was based on a Plains Nation, I can't remember specifically which one, that was basically about the concepts of two genders residing within the same person, two spirits. And so that's become a really powerful symbol for a lot of indigenous queer and transgender creators and people.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people may not be familiar with, is in a lot of indigenous cultures, that their concepts of gender sexuality are oftentimes very different from, I guess, what we'd say is like traditional Western concepts of it. And sometimes much more complicated in some ways, too.
Yeah, I mean, it really, really does depend on the nation. The other problem, of course, too, is that when the church came and started importing a lot of values, it become all very mixed up and confusing. And so it can be hard sometimes to sort through what are church teachings and what is traditional teachings. So a lot of the creators in this book reached out to elders in their community to discuss the concepts before they wrote the story.
Oh, that's interesting. So there was actual communication with their local group and everything in terms of talking about these.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really important thing, because some stories aren't meant to be told. Some teachings aren't meant to be told, because you can see when they get out into kind of general white culture, they become like bastardized versions. Like look at Bigfoot, right? Like Bigfoot is just a comedy kind of monster character now, but its origins lie in more spiritual storytelling. So there's reasons why some stories are meant not to be told outside of the community. So checking with the elders is a really good way of ensuring that it's a story that's okay to be told.
That's very interesting. So I had not really known that. It's fascinating. So, okay, so going back specifically to the collection, So you originally described this being very uplifting, and it has a number of works that are all dealing with these specific concepts, LGBT concepts, and dealing with this sort of uplifting perspective. And I know you'd mentioned that it was really important that we have this in this world, and I wanted you to kind of dig in a little bit more onto what value we really get from having these very positive kind of stories versus, you know, what science fiction fantasy often is, which is very socially conscious and kind of, it can be a little bit of a tough pill to chew.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, too, the comics from this decade, a lot of what draws me now to stories are ones that are more happier and pleasant in tone, because I think a lot of us are seeking escapist literature. But that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Like, I think it's very important to be able to take yourself away from the trauma for a little bit, to take yourself away from the world as it's always kind of pressing down on you. And I think it's really important to be able to imagine our own futures. So being able to offer that to other readers as a publisher is something really important. Yeah. So I guess does that answer your question?
No, I think that gets it. Yeah, that's great. It's great. Okay. So we're getting close to the end here. And I just want to ask one more question about Love Beyond Body, Space, and Time. And that is, so this is a collection of stories from a very particular side of, I suppose, the science fiction fantasy community that often isn't heard very, very often. And you've written a number of collections that are about indigenous stories. So what led you originally to getting interested in telling, or rather having others, I guess, putting collections together of indigenous perspectives on whatever the topics may be? Because you've done comics collections and so on, too.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I guess for me, a lot of it is growing up in a community where there is a lot of Aboriginal population, like in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and having friends who are Native and not being able to see their stories anywhere, it kind of wears on you. And when I moved to Toronto, I was really shocked that a lot of the stuff that I had been taught in history classes as normal, things like residential school systems, things like Louis Riel's Rebellion, were just not heard of there. And it was shocking to see what kind of regionalism exists from place to place. And I was used to already experiencing and seeing the racism against the Native population in Winnipeg. And then to move from that, which is awful and degrading and disheartening, to Toronto, where there's a complete eraser of Indigenous identity, was shocking. So I kind of just want to be able to create a space for people to tell their own stories and use my abilities to help promote and sell and market the stories to be able to reach as wide of an audience as possible. So all in all, like, these are not my stories, and I never want to claim ownership over them at all. But I like to just think of myself as a facilitator to help other people tell theirs.
Awesome. That's fantastic. So let us know first where folks can find the Spectacular Sisterhood of Superwomen.
Oh, yeah. You can buy it at bookstores, wherever your books are sold locally. If you can't find it, or if you don't have any bookstore near you, you can always buy it online on Amazon or Powell's or Chapters Indigo or whatever big online bookstore you have.
And the same question to Love Beyond Body, Space, and Time.
Love Beyond, you can also buy on Amazon. You can buy it on my website at hopenicholson.com. And you can also buy it from Chapters Indigo in Canada and Powell's in the States.
Oh, Powell's. Powell's is good. Shout out to Powell's.
Yeah, Powell's, they've been so great. Such a great supporter of small press, because most bookstores like Barnes & Noble will not even look at my book. But Powell's has always been very enthusiastic about promoting small press publishers, and I couldn't be more thankful for that.
So I was going to ask you where to find you, but you already said your website, so I don't have to ask that anymore.
Yeah, my website is hopenicholson.com. I also have Twitter, Hope L. Nicholson, or my corporate Twitter is Bedside Press.
Fantastic. So thank you so much, Hope, for joining us and telling us about these great works. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on Signal Booth. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.